Good afternoon. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to see you. The title of the talk is The Cradle of the Breath. This last weekend, I was at St. Mary's in Suwannee teaching with my colleague Paloma Cain. And Paloma had a formulation that I had not heard before, but it really it stuck with me. It's very portable, very transportable. It's a Tibetan formulation, and I used it in the meditation tonight. It's that the chair is supporting the body, and chair's holding the body. You just kind of feel into that in the pew or the cushion, wherever you're sitting. Feeling that support, as it were, from the ground up. And then the body is holding the breathing, not holding on to, not holding the breath, but it's supporting the whole process of breathing. It's an embodied experience. And if you feel the breath, not so much at the rim of the nostrils, but as the breath makes its way down to the lower lobes of the lungs and the diaphragm pushes down, and with that muscular movement, you may be able to feel the breath all the way in the pelvic floor, really all the way to the seat. And this really connects with the grounding of the seat. So there's the earth that's holding the chair and the chair supporting the body. And then the body is really supporting from the ground up this process of breathing. And then there are these contents of mind, the inner world of thoughts and feelings. And those can ride the breath, or the language I'm going to use is, they can be rocked in the cradle of the breath. I really like that image a lot. If you think about cradling a child, rocking a child, the child's just altogether supported and can just sink into this stable attachment, this stable bond. So chair supporting the body, body supporting the breath, and then the rocking of the breath, the cradling of the breath, supporting whatever's coming down the mind stream. One of the retreatants who was with us this weekend gave me this report of his experience. He said he was out walking, and he just noticed that, you know, the thought factory was active. He was just doing his usual running his traps of thoughts. But he noticed, because he'd been paying attention to his body, he noticed that when this was going on in his mind, that there was a closing of the throat. He said he didn't know really what this was, what the anatomical mechanism was, whether it's the closing of the epiglottis over the windpipe or whatever, the back of the tongue pushing up. But at any rate, he felt this closing upwards, this kind of lifting upwards. And then he realized, oh my gosh, there's a whole cascade of connection. The muscles of the throat are linked into this, and then the pectoral muscles below the clavicles, on down through the heart space and the belly. And he said he could feel this upward lift really from his pelvic floor all the way up into this. That's really finely tuned bodily awareness. But he said that as soon as he noticed it, there was just this cascade of relaxation. So that's good mindfulness practice, is noticing tensing, and in the very noticing, softening. Jan Fraser, who's a teacher I've mentioned in here any number of times before, she's got a lovely e-book called The Great Sweetening, and then a book in print called the freedom of being. She says there's this over and over again sequence of tightening. You know, the mind gets going, thoughts get going, and we tighten in some way physically. And then noticing this tightening, like noticing the throat closing. And then softening. The very act of noticing can bring about a softening. It's not like we're trying to soften. The softening just happens with the noticing. That's the miracle of mindfulness. So I want you to wonder with me, softening into what? What is it that we're softening into? So if you've been with us for the last couple of weeks, I've been talking about this map of ever more subtle levels of bodily awareness, these 9 levels of awakening that my teacher Philip Moffitt talks about. And the first 3 bodies, the physical body and what's called the vital body and the emotional body, these are just what we think of as our familiar selves. It's just, you know, what you think of as me, as ourselves. But this that notices the tightening, and by the very act of noticing the softening, this that notices, this that is aware, that's where the softening takes place. So last week we were talking about noticing just the tingling in your hands. If you go inside from the bones outwards and feel this tingling in your hands, these sparkles of sensation. And through the body, using the body as a kind of antenna, we can notice, oh, what's aware of these sparkles of sensation? We ask that question using the body. It's not a head question. This is not an information question. This is an embodied inquiry. And when we make that inquiry, the mind itself may stop. The thought factory may become quiet. And we soften, we descend into a different kind of knowing. We would call it insight in this tradition. It's more an intuitional knowing than an analytical kind of knowing. After the retreatants had been with us for maybe a little less than 24 hours, we gave them an opportunity to kind of open up about their experience, to talk about it. And almost to a person, they said they weren't having any fun at all. And boy, this is really the way retreat works. I mean, the first couple of days on retreat are like shakedown cruise. And you know, all the exhaustion, all the fatigue, all the just heavy baggage that you're carrying around with you, it just comes with you on retreat. And sometimes I think we really shouldn't do these weekend retreats because they're just so tough. And it's not until about day 3 or 4, long about the time they're getting ready to leave, that they could actually settle in and do some more work. But what we had was a weekend retreat. And what they reported was, almost to a person, either great fatigue or just this restlessness of mind. You know, the mind just going on and on and on, and to use their words, quote, not being able to stop it. And so Paloma and I looked at each other and it's like, which one of us is going to talk about what the Buddha called the 5 hindrances to clear seeing? And we've talked about this any number of times in here. But for those on the retreat who had not heard this, it was like, oh, I'm not alone in this. Like, this is a common human experience. I mean, this is the common offering. And so these five hindrances, as some of you know, are grasping and aversion. They're kind of one coin with two sides. And then fatigue and restlessness, that's what the retreatants were really reporting. And then the mother of all hindrances, which is doubt. And doubt, of course, is, this is not going to work for me. In fact, one person said to me, I was really just about to pack my bags and leave. We call that rolling up the mat. Right? So like rolling up your yoga mat. It's like, I am done here. I am out of here. Right? Some of you may be ready to roll up the mat here. Okay? So we talked a little about these five hindrances, and we're all familiar with this. The mind that's just, like a dog with a bone. It's just grinding on something and doesn't seem to be able to let go of it. Or then that mind is just pushing away, pushing away, pushing away. I don't want to be thinking about this. I don't want to be dealing with this. I don't want this in my neighborhood. You know, when the leaf blower was outside, I was having a little bit of that aversive mind. It's like, really? You know? So these things just come up unbidden. You know, there's nothing. We're not failing at mindfulness if they come up. The failure, if you will, is not noticing. Oh, aversion's like this. Not liking the leaf blower is like this, or wanting something desperately, perhaps wanting something, or even just subtly wanting something. Like, oh, I'd really like to have a good meditation this afternoon, or I'd like not to be so sleepy, or whatever it must be. That's grasping and aversion. Then there's restlessness and fatigue. Fatigue in the tradition is known as sloth and torpor, which are kind of expressive words. But fatigue is probably a little bit more common experience. I'm just curious. I mean, you don't have to raise your hand on this, but just how many of us feel a certain level of fatigue this afternoon? Just let me see your hands. Yeah, so that's well over half. By the way, as we're making this transition into fall, and with winter not far behind, we're moving out of the, in terms of Chinese medicine, the yang time of the year, the bright time of the year, the spring and the summer growth time of the year. And now it's the seeding time, and the seeds falling into the ground. And then just being held by the ground. This is the yin time of year. This is the time for rest and recovery. Not that we're particularly good at it in this culture. In fact, we gear up with the holidays. They're not too far behind, which is really going counter to the natural energy of the earth and of our bodies. But the invitation here is just to recognize, oh, how can I nourish my body, my mind, and my heart, especially? What will give me some nourishment? What will feed me? Who will feed me? Who will it be good for me to be with? Who maybe not so much? You know, there are... there are these Dracula folks that we have in our lives, right? So we have to use some discretion about, you know, who we choose to be around, especially in this season of really needing. I mean, if you've been going through, I'm looking at some faces, and I know some people who have really been going through some rapids in their lives. You know, how can I paddle the boat sort of to the shore and get out and rest on the bank a little bit? And then there's, you know, the hindrance of doubt, and doubt is, you know, I don't know whether this is going to work for me, or really doubting the teachers. Do they know what they're talking about? Um, you know, maybe I'm not doing the right practice. Sharon Salzberg tells a great story about being in Bodh Gaya, you know, the place of the Buddha's awakening. And she's sitting with this insight meditation teacher named Manindra. And almost all the time she's sitting there, what she's doing and working in her mind, she's saying, should I be working with the Tibetans right now? I mean, that's the way she's meditating. It's like thinking, I really ought to be someplace else. That's the mind of doubt at work. You know, the mind of doubt says, will I ever be okay? Will calm ever come to my life? Peace come into my life? Will recovery happen for the persons that I love? Mind of doubt is just working those thoughts. So we can drop all of the hindrances into this grounding of the seat, of the chair, the cushion, the pew. Rather than trying to work all these at the level of the thought factory, which we know, we all know, do we not, that that doesn't work, but it doesn't stop us from doing it, does it? But we can remind ourselves, oh, could I drop down into earth? Drop into earth and drop back into the breath. These are real refuges. And then drop into the cradling of the breath. Perhaps you could feel it during the meditation. When we really drop any control of our breath and just let the breath take us where it wants to go, long or short, deep or shallow, you know, just like it does when we're asleep. There is this really tender cradling in the breath. And there's not one of us that does not need that tenderness, that does not need that holding. So we can drop aversion and grasping and restlessness and fatigue and doubt. We can drop all these all too human experiences into the cradle of the breath. I haven't always done this on these mindfulness retreats because it's not part of the sort of the insight meditation orthodoxy. But I said to the retreatants, I said, this is real optional, but I just do this daily celebration of communion in the morning, and if any of you want to come join me, that's fine. And, you know, maybe a quarter of the people on the retreat did. And after the retreat, one of the men on the retreat came up to me, and he said, could you tell me what communion is? And I thought, wow, that is a great question. I don't think anybody has put it to me quite like that in a long time. And I thought, you know, this man is not looking for the answer from the catechism. You know, he's not looking for the official answer. It's like, what actually is going on here? So I said, let me just drop into this question for a minute. Because I didn't want to give him, you know, kind of the first thing off the top of the head. And I thought about some of the actual words that Jesus uses. And he says, you know, he takes the cup and he gives thanks. And he says, drink this, all of you. Like everybody at the table, you know. Judas, you drink this. Peter, you drink this. All these different people, you drink this. So I said to him, I think the first thing about communion is welcome. It's like everybody's welcome here. I mean, really, that we got to this place where, you know, you had to be a part of our tribe in order to have communion in our church. I mean, how did we ever get there? You know, so that communion has become a ritual of exclusion rather than a ritual of inclusion. So the first thing it's about is welcome. And it's not just, you know, like, you know, your body is welcome, but it's like all of you is welcome too. Like all of y'all are welcome, but all of y'all inside, all those different parts of you, you know, especially the parts of you that think you think aren't welcome. You know, and aren't dressed up for public presentation. Those parts are really welcome. Really welcome. And then I said, I think that that what's going on in here is an experience of deep connection. You know, like really connecting with your embodied experience. Like, you know, this is my body. This is my blood. Like, and I'm giving this to you. I'm inviting you into this deep connection. Frederick Buechner uses the language of the me and thee. You know, like, when I give you this food, I'm in you. I'm going in you. And every cell of your body, and you're in me. We're really in this together. There's this deep sense of non-separation of connectedness. And then I made a connection with what we've been doing in our Qigong practice and our movement practice. It was a spectacular weekend on the mountain in Suwannee. And so we were outside doing Qigong on the bluff, which looks out over the valley below and over to the Cumberland Plateau across the valley. And we were just standing, and I invited the participants to, as we've done in here any number of times, to look out at the mountains across the valley from their heart space, to drop the eyes into the heart and to look out from the heart space. And then to invite the mountains across to look back at us. And one of the retreatants said, as we were doing our sort of final sharing about what the retreat had been like, he said, you know, I just really wasn't getting it about this Qigong. Like, you're doing all this energy ball stuff. And he said, it just wasn't making it with me. He said, but when we looked out at the mountains from the heart space and invited the mountains to look back at us, he said, whoa, something really happened there. There was some kind of communion. So that's another thing that's going on in communion, is there is looking from the heart space and there's being seen from the heart space. And so there's this holding, this seeing, this being held. So the retreat ended, and there was sort of an hour between. And then people began arriving for the dedication of the memorial garden to my wife, Kathy, that happened. And I want to tell you a little bit about this story. There are some of you who were there. And it was just sweet beyond belief. I mean, it was really, really sweet. I have to tell you, it was one of the best days of my life. It really was. It was that good. So I was checking in for the retreat on Friday, and this guy comes up to the window where I'm standing, and he's got this mallet, a striker, in his hands, and he says to the receptionist there, he says, "This is an extra mallet for the bell," and I said, because I didn't know this guy, and I said, "Are you Dan Craner?" And he said, "Yeah, I am." Well, I said, "I'm Gordon Pierman." I said, I'm the husband of Kathy. And he said, oh. So this was the man, he's a woodworker. And he took time off from building Vince Gill's studio to build the gates of the garden, of Kathy's garden. I mean, he's a no-kidding woodworker. And what he had done, I've mentioned this in before, he had constructed these gates like the ones you see at Shinto shrines. They're called Torii gates, and they have two vertical bars and then two horizontal bars. And he said, could we go out to the garden and talk about this? And I said, oh, absolutely. So we had about an hour together where he talked to me about his creative process. And he said that what he had done was to come up on the land to meet with John Runkle, who was the director of St. Mary's, but he's an Episcopal priest, but he's also an architect, which is just a great combination. And John and Dan started talking about who Kathy was, and particularly this combination of, being raised the daughter of an Episcopal priest, and then having this profound connection with East Asian Buddhism. And so Dan was just kind of messing around in his creative process, and he got to thinking about these Shinto shrines. But what he didn't know is that the actual Chinese character of these two vertical lines and these two horizontal lines, it means gate. So these gates in Chinese language mean gate. So Dan was out there working on these gates one day, and a student from the university came by, and she was Chinese, she spoke Chinese, and so he shared with him this understanding of the meaning of the character, and she said, yes, it means gate, but it also means open. So here's this, and I really want y'all to go to St. Mary's Swami sometime, come on retreat, to see this garden and to be in this garden. At either end of the garden path are these Shinto shrine gates, these Torii gates. And then there is a holding of a Zen bell, and it's different from this bell. It's not a circular bell, but it's one hanging from the gates, and it's more vertical than horizontal. And then there's the Tara statue, the statue of the Bodhisattva of Compassion that my friend Rabbi Rami Shapiro gave in memory of Kathy, that's there. And then there's the view, the view, which is what you really come to St. Mary's for, this million-dollar view out onto the Cumberland Plateau. So about an hour before the ceremony, the official ceremony, our family gathered, and we took the last of Kathy's ashes and we scattered them there in the garden. And my 9-year-old and 10-year-old grandsons, Cecil and Hugo, were the masters of this ceremony, which was pretty fabulous. Kathy had said before she died, she said, so, some of me will be at Mount Olivet, with your family's plot out there. But she said, someday in the fall, I want you to take the rest of my ashes and scatter them somewhere at Swanee. She didn't know at that time that this garden was going to be built. And it took 3 years for the garden to be built, but it also took 3 years for me to be in a place where I could do this ceremony. So the timing was just perfect. So Hugo and Cecil were spooning these ashes out of this Amari bowl, and they were just having the time of their lives. And Kathy had said, I don't want anything formal about this. I just want this to be easy. And so all of us, sisters, in-laws, we were all just spreading these ashes. And by the time we'd done everything we wanted to do at the garden, there's still about, half the ashes left. So we went down to the edge of the bluff itself. And Kathy's son, Cecil, had the inspiration to take a handful of these ashes, and it was really a windy day on the mountain, and just to throw these ashes to the wind and let the wind take them where they would. Everybody thought that was a great idea, so we all did that. And it was this, it was like seeing the ashes dance in the wind. You know, dancing with the breath, being cradled in the breath and taken to their final resting place. So all that was really special. And then we had the actual dedication of the garden. And my old buddy, my Episcopal priest colleague, Tom Ward, had left me a voicemail before the service. And he said, you know, when you do the loving kindness prayers, he said, I've seen what you're going to say. And he said, there's one person you've left out of the prayers. He said, you've left yourself out of the prayers. He said, I want you to include yourself in the loving kindness prayer. So John Runkle, the architect priest, talked about just the evolution of the garden, how it had all come to be. And then Margaret, Kathy's sister, read this poem, this Wendell Berry poem, which Kathy had read at our wedding at the Japanese Garden in Cheekwood. I've read it here any number of times, but I think you can get how perfect this poem was for this particular moment. So we're up there and the wind is in the trees. I mean, the trees are just talking. And right at the moment she was to read this poem, the wind died down so that you could hear her. And she said, I go among trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them asleep like cattle. Then what is afraid of me comes and lives a while in my sight. What it fears in me leaves me, and the fear of me leaves it. It sings and I hear its song. Then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves it, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings, and I hear its song. After days of labor mute in my consternations, I hear my song at last. And I sing it as we sing, the day turns, the trees move. Our grandsons had rung the bell to begin this formal service. And then my dear friend Bob Smith read Psalm 84. Bob is godfather to my son Alex. Alex had flown down from New York just for the day, and in classic 27-year-old fashion, he had missed his flight out of LaGuardia, but he found another flight and was able to get down there. And Bob read this psalm, and there's a particular connection here. Kathy had two totem birds. One was the bluebirds. And when Alex and I went on our walk after the service, of course, what we saw were bluebirds. But Kathy's other totem bird was the wren. She just liked those little brown wrens and their really special song. I think she identified with the sort of understated, non-flashy, beauty of wrens. And so this is the psalm at Psalm 84. Lord, how beautiful you are. How radiant the places you dwell in. My soul yearns for your presence. My whole body longs for your light. Even the wren finds a house and the sparrow a nest for herself. Take me home, Lord. Guide me to the place of perfect repose. Let me feel you always within me. Open my eyes to your love. Happy are those who trust you and merge their will in your will. They let go of all desires and give up everything they know until they finally enter the inmost temple of the heart where there is no self, no other, nothing, but only you. So if that doesn't sound familiar to you, it's Stephen Mitchell's translation of the Psalms. It's this little book, which he doesn't translate all the Psalms, but they're exquisite translations. I commend it to you. Before that, I did the loving kindness prayer. I said, you know, when Kathy and I would finish our morning practice, finish our Qigong and our sitting, she would always recite these words to herself. She would say, "May I receive whatever this day brings. May all the circumstances of my life serve the awakening of wisdom and compassion." That's what she would say. And I said, you know, that's what she asked for. She asked for that, and she got it. It really happened. And I did the loving kindness prayers, and, you know, I said, "You're familiar with all these words, you know." I said, "May Kathy's mother and father, Marie and Cecil, be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May they be calm and peaceful and safe and happy, and may they awaken to the beauty of their true nature and be free." Kathy's 93-year-old mom was there. Her dad, Cecil, is buried in the cemetery at Sewanee. So we wish these wishes for the living and the dead, for her sisters, for her children and grandchildren, for her students, for her friends, for all those who loved her, and for St. Mary's, it's where she went to high school. It was a girls' school, an Episcopal girls' school, and she was in the last graduating class, and then it became a retreat center. Before the nuns came there in the late 1800s, Native Americans had lived there. It was a place of real spiritual, it's a spiritual PowerPoint there, it's a real spiritual connection. And then at my friend Tom's behest, I said, "And because Kathy would have wanted it, may I be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness." And I really just sort of came apart at that point. I just choked my way through the words. And my stepdaughter Josephine came up, you know, just out of the group and just embraced me, just held me. My brother Bill and I were talking about this. Out of our Germanic family background, Pyrmans would never have done this. You know, just never. As Bill said, "We would just let you burn on the spot." But Josephine, in her just natural, spontaneous warmth, just came up and embraced me. And then she sat back down, and the rest of the service continued. But my 10-year-old grandson, Hugo, came and just stood beside me, just kept watch for the rest of the service. It was unbelievably sweet. It was so sweet. There were tears for all of us, but these were not tears of heartbrokenness. These were the tears of connection. Some things just take a while. Grief just has its own timing. The English novelist E.M. Forster, you know him? Howard's End, A Room with a View, A Passage to India, Morris. He says, only connect. Only connect. That's what communion's about. It's about connecting. Rocking in the cradle of the breath. Whatever is here, whatever is true for you, only connect. Connect with what is true for you. Connect with what's true for other folks and connect with something more subtle beyond what you think of as yourself, your familiar self, if you will, your ordinary self, or what Merton might have called our false self. Because there's something truer to connect with. And it's this subtle thing that when we turn and look from the heart and invite ourselves to be seen from the heart, then we're connecting with this that is subtle, that is beyond naming. It's the sacred, it's the holy, it's the holy, holy, holy. It's where everything lives and moves and has its being. So that's it for a moment. So resting down on earth, and seat supporting the body. And body supporting the breath all the way down to the pelvic floor. And the breath supporting all the contents of mind and heart. The ones you want, the ones you don't want. Cradling them all. So we'll do our call and response form of loving kindness. I'll say a phrase and you echo it back. May you be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May you be calm and peaceful. May you be safe and happy. May you awaken to the beauty of your true nature and be free. So we send these wishes out to all those whom we hold in our hearts. And just see who's there. Just name them one by one. We are in those whom we love. They are in us. And we send these wishes out to all those who have helped us along our way, our journey in this life, our teachers, our mentors, our friends. See who comes to mind. Remembering them. Remember them again in your mind and heart. And strangers, persons whose names we don't know. Persons on the street, persons on the road, persons in the news, all want to awaken to the beauty of their true nature and be free. as well as our difficult persons, those who challenge us, upset us, scare us. May they too be filled with loving kindness and awaken. Awaken. So we send these wishes out without exception to all beings, all human beings, all more than human beings. Four-leggeds, two-leggeds, winged ones, all beings, may all beings be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May all beings be calm and peaceful and safe and happy. May all beings, may all of us awaken to the beauty of our true nature and be free. We dedicate the merit of our practice this evening to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of peace and joy and happiness, and to the ending of suffering. So we're back to our usual schedule on Sunday afternoons. The Mindfulness and Inquiry Group meets at my home, number 10 Peach Blossom Square, 5 p.m. Sundays. Rabbi Rami Shapiro and I will be leading a retreat at St. Mary's the first weekend in December. It's on birthing the Christ within. I've always looked forward to leading this kind of retreat with a rabbi. I think that's all I know tonight. Thank you so much for being here, for your really sweet attention tonight, for your generosity in the Donna baskets and back and online. Have a lovely week. See you next week.